Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on tax reform.
We pay the highest tax of any country in the world on businesses, and we can't keep doing that. Last week, I repeated my principles for tax reform. First, we must make the tax code as simple as possible. It's extremely complex, it's not fair, and it's extremely hard to understand.
Make no mistake, tax reform is a heavy lift for Congress. That's why it's been more than three decades since the tax code was updated and reformed. What's so complicated about it? I think you'll get a sense of that as you listen to 6th District Congressman Tom Emmer and I talk about it. But for you, as we begin our conversation, if you own a small business, what do you want to see changed in the tax code? If you take that mortgage interest deduction, and a lot of us do, how would you feel about giving that up to make the tax code fair? So we're going to talk about some of the elements of the debate around tax reform. But I'd like you to kind of look back on your own household budget and maybe your own business budget and talk to me about what makes sense to you, what you want to hang on to, what you're willing to give up, and give the congressman some information here that he can take back to Washington. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. You can talk to me about it on Twitter. It's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Welcome, Congressman Emmer. Good to have you in the studio. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the corporate tax code. Corporate profits are a greater share of the GDP today than they have been in more than 30 years. If companies needed more money to invest, it appears that they've got it, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the corporate tax and the argument that somehow profits are related to or would go up with a reduction of the corporate tax, I suppose that's true. But, Carrie, from my position, the corporate tax is a fraud. The consumer is paying the corporate tax already.
Explain why you say that.
Because as you heard with the clip that you played of the president, he's talking about we have the highest corporate tax of any of the countries that practice free market economics. There are 35 to 40 countries that make up something called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. These are Western or Western-friendly countries that primarily practice free market economics. The U.S. is at a 35% rate. You will find the bulk of them, I think the U.K. is around 23, 24. You'll go all the way down to Ireland, that's 12, 12 and a half. But the bulk of them are 20 to 25. I said initially that it's a fraud because that 35% rate here in this country, mm-hmm. when a corporation is doing business, it factors that into the price of goods and services. So ultimately, guess who's paying the corporate tax?
So is that you're saying that is the compelling argument for lowering the corporate tax rate, not because it's going to benefit the companies themselves, but
no.
because they won't be passing the costs on to consumers? Well, what is the compelling argument?
I was responding to your statement about profits, that ultimately the profits are being fueled by the same thing right now.
That's what the argument is that the corporations make, that we need these reduced taxes because then we would have more profits to put back into the company to hire more people and create more jobs.
Well,
you say,
That's the rhetoric that a lot of us use. But I'm telling you that from the standpoint responding to you, ultimately, the corporate tax is a fraud. We're paying that, you and me, right now. But let's get back to why it's important. Because right now, you see companies like Anheuser-Busch being purchased by German companies. You see corporate inversions with Medtronic,
right.
for instance, right here in Minnesota.
I was going to ask you about that.
Why is that happening? Well, it's happening because if you conduct foreign operations, you not only get taxed at the rate, and in this case, Medtronic became Covidien. Right. So they became an Irish company, which is taxed, I think, in one of the lowest rates at 12 or 12.5%. But they have operations, for instance, in the UK. So if they're producing products in the UK, the production and any income revenue that they generate in the UK gets taxed at the UK's rate of 23 or 24, whatever it is. And then if they want to bring that money home after it's been taxed once already, it will be taxed again at the US rate of 35%. So what does that mean? That money doesn't come home. The issue is you've got $2 trillion plus that is estimated to be offshore. We need to reverse the flow of the dollars as opposed to being outside the country back in.
Where's the guarantee that if you wouldn't lower the tax rate to, well, I'm glad you brought up Medtronic, because as you know, that tax inversion was pretty controversial and a number of other companies were doing it at about the same time. If you didn't lower the corporate tax rate to somewhere where Ireland is at or the UK is at, and we can talk about the range that's being debated, what's the guarantee that they would onshore, a company like Medtronic that's already gone through with the inversion, would onshore and pay taxes on the profits anyway? They don't have to.
Well, there's never any guarantee. But if you talk to the CEOs, and by the way, Medtronic was controversial. It might have been for the
tax inversion.
Inversion might have been for journalists and for the news folks here in the United States. But in the boardroom, where the board has a fiduciary obligation to its shareholders, at some point, the board had to do it. And why is that? It's because the policy
put
them in a position.
So every American company that has a fiduciary responsibility to its board should undertake a tax inversion?
To its shareholders. At a certain point, you can't justify. You are not doing the best thing. You're not meeting your fiduciary obligation to your shareholders. Frankly, you're in a Hobson's choice. You want to stay in the United States. Your employees, your home is here in Minnesota when it comes to Medtronic. But the numbers don't allow you to do that. You have to do what's in the best interest of the company and the shareholders that you are representing. So you lose in the public, this square of public opinion, right? Because people are like, look at that. They're greedy. They're going to Ireland. We need to think about the policy that caused that. Now, does that mean you reduce taxes to zero? No. But you got to understand why companies like Anheuser-Busch, Monsanto, why companies that are American companies are suddenly becoming foreign companies.
So, Congressman, it is true, just to linger on the inversions here for a minute, that Medtronic and some of these other companies benefit, I think one of the big pharmaceutical companies did this as well, benefit from being American companies. I mean, they benefit from our infrastructure, they benefit from our market, they benefit from our educated workforce. And yet, when it comes to putting some of those profits back into the American economy, you see no ethical, I'm not saying it's not legal, you see no ethical question about holding that money out, even given all of the benefits they get from being an American company.
Actually, what I'm telling you is they are in an ethical dilemma because they owe this fiduciary obligation to their shareholders, and yet they want to stay in the United States. So why
I think they've got the best of all worlds,
well,
don't they?
Not if, when I go back to the example, go back to the UK, you get taxed where it's generated, and then you get taxed again when it comes back. It doesn't work. So guess what? The proposal is to bring this corporate tax down. And by the way, I had an economics professor yesterday at St. John's suggest we should just get rid of the corporate tax and we should increase the individual income tax. I don't want to get into that debate because that's not being discussed. What's being discussed is bring the corporate tax down to 25% or lower. President right now wants 15. There's a proposal in the House for 20%. And over on the Senate side, I think Senator Hatch, who's in charge of the tax reform on the Senate side, has suggested 25%. But you've got this. If you bring it down to that rate, number one, you would say that policy would now reverse the flow of those dollars. But second, Kerry, what's been talked about for the last two Congresses is you also then give an even lower rate for the one-time repatriation. So, again, if you estimate there's some $2 trillion that is right now staying offshore, you create a situation where you not only put the policy in place that you believe will reverse those flow, even the playing field, so that you don't have money flowing out and not coming back.
What would that rate be for the repatriation, the one time the money that's being held offshore?
There is no firm proposal, but it's somewhere between 9 and 13%. And what I've heard regularly recently is that it's 10% or less.
Let's take some calls, but then we'll come back and talk about what that means for the budget overall to lose that money. To Mark in North Oaks. Hey, Mark, hi.
Good morning. I think the congressman is being disingenuous. If corporations don't pay the tax, people will. If they permit companies to lodge money and sit it overseas and not pay taxes on it, that means we have to pay more. I would like to see our companies that do business worldwide pay taxes on that so that individuals will pay less.
What do you think of that, Congressman?
Well, again, I can only tell Mark How are you going to do that, Mark? We don't have a one-world government. These countries all have their own sovereignty, and they do what they're going to do in the best interest of their company, their country. We are in a competition for our own companies and our great capacity to produce in this country. And I don't know how you can suggest it's disingenuous when I've already pointed out to you that a good business, because, again, they're doing what's in the best interest of the business and the shareholders. They want to support the business and grow the business. They are going to pass that corporate tax right on through to the consumer. So you're already paying it.
Congressman, what happens to the acknowledged loss of this money into the federal budget if you lower the corporate tax rate? And where does how does the gap get filled in?
Well,
where do you find the money for that?
Again, if you go back and the argument that people make, let's start with, if you start to reduce the tax burden and you allow for more growth within your economy, you will have added revenues. The argument the government makes all the time whenever you talk about a tax cut is every time you reduce the tax burden, you cost government money. It's an expense. Okay. Why is that? It's because government's already calculated the dollars that we are paying as their money. And that really is not the way to look at it. It's about economic growth, Kerry. Right now, we've been struggling. Well, under the Trump administration, we're now up to 3%.
You got a little bit below that.
Well, you're right. Close to 3%. I mean, most people have been rounding it to 3. You're probably accurate. But the point is, you can't do this at 2% growth on an annual basis. You got to be 3, 4% or better. And the only way you can do that, history has proven, you must reduce the tax burden, the overall tax burden. You must streamline regulation, and you must have a better monetary policy.
You just said history has proven this.
Yes.
You know that what critics call this is trickle-down economics, and there really is not economic theory to support what you're saying, that if you automatically reduce taxes on businesses and then it will spur economic growth and people's quality of life will increase economically. There is no real economic theory to support that.
Actually, Kerry,
it's
history,
political theory, isn't
history
it?
History has absolutely proven it. In fact, economists talk about the great boom period, which began in the mid-80s and didn't end until sometime around the beginning of this century. It was the largest period of wealth creation the world has ever known, and it happened right here in this country, and it happened because of those three things. It happened under Republicans and Democrats in the executive office.
You know that under President Clinton's administration, regulations increased, that there was not trickle-down economics at work, and we had a boom during that administration. So history shows us, right, that we can have more regulation and higher taxes and still have economic growth.
Again, Kerry, it started in the 80s. It was based on tax cuts, which is the last time we did any real tax reform. It was streamlining regulation, so you don't have to go to 5 different windows when you're trying to start a business like you do in some cases in this state, 5 different bureaucracies, and a monetary policy which actually manages the dollar and promotes the creation of wealth, which is what raises the boats for everyone in a country. Guess what? Under both Republicans and Democrats, including Reagan, including Clinton, they started to change that over the next 20 years. The economy grew, and it was wonderful. But at some point, we hit that breaking point again, and we're there.
So what is the projected economic growth percentage that you believe if this tax reform passes and we're living under some of the new regulations or fewer regulations that you're talking about? What is the projected growth that you think we could achieve?
Well, again, if I were going to do that, I'd be as bad as some of the weather people out there right now. You can't predict it. Economics is a lot like predicting the weather. It involves human beings. It involves what they're going to do. What we saw under the great boom period, we had one quarter that was 7% growth. We have people now who say you'll never get back there. I disagree.
That was during the tech boom, wasn't it?
Actually, that was before, I believe. That was in the tech boom was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the one quarter of—
Isn't that when the last real economic boom occurred?
Actually, it started in the 90s. It started in the
80s.
It started in the mid to late 80s.
Let's go to the phones to Dominic in Chaska, Minnesota. Hey, Dominic, thanks for waiting.
You're welcome. I just wish we could focus, instead of the responsibility to the shareholder, we get back to the responsibility to the stakeholder. which is the employees that work for the company, not just the people who own the stock in the company. It's the local economies that depend on the workers. I keep hearing about the responsibility that we have to shareholders.
Okay.
And we've gotten away from stakeholders.
Congressman, what about that?
Mark, I guess, actually,
that was
this
Dominic.
Was Dominic.
Yeah.
Dominic. We were talking about that. Sorry if I didn't point out when you're if you were listening to me in my response to Mark, I was talking about how it's protecting the company and making sure that the company is viable and it's growing. And that is about the employees. And by the way, this is what a free market economy is all about. The growth will go to where it's needed most. So if something is viable, if it's real, if it provides value to the community, it will continue to grow and the community benefits. What you're talking about or what you're suggesting, respectfully, is something that's more of a government-controlled entity, which I don't think we want.
So one last call on the corporate tax rate, and then I want to talk about some of the other elements of this. We might have lost him to... Well, to Leonard in St. Paul. I'm sorry, Leonard. Hi. Welcome. Thanks
Hello.
For waiting. What's your question?
My question is, I didn't hear the entire discussion, but I hear all this talk about a 35% tax rate. But according to an article in Forbes, the effective tax rate in the United States is not much different from the average worldwide tax rate. So I'm unclear why this 35% it continues to be emphasized.
Are you saying, Leonard, that from the reading that you've done, that very few corporations actually pay that full 35%?
I can't imagine a large corporation not trying to lower their tax rate as much as they can.
Congressman?
First, Leonard, thank you. I would love to see the Forbes article you're talking about because— The reality is it's not only 35%, but when you put in state and local taxes, the real burden that some of these companies end up facing is closer to 40%. It's around 39. But he brings up a great point. You've got companies like General Electric. We've seen the stories where General Electric not too long ago actually had an effective tax rate of zero. But the idea that this applies to all corporations in the country is a fallacy, because if it did— If it were, as Leonard got from that article, which, again, I'd love to see, then you wouldn't see these companies doing the tax inversions. You wouldn't see them doing the offshore stuff that they are, because what the argument is, you want that money to come back here if you're the CEO of this of a company, because this is the strongest economy on the face of the planet.
And yet, Congressman, just one more question now that we're back on the tax inversions. I mean, we talked about the one-time rate, of the repatriation of this money that's being held offshore, quote unquote. But if you come in somewhere where the president, somewhere in between where the president and Congress is, you're still going to have a higher corporate tax rate than many of these other countries, especially somewhere like Ireland. And that brings us back to this Medtronic deal. What's to stop more of these companies from still saying, we don't want to pay 25%? In the U.S., the inversions might not necessarily stop.
Again, they have to do their own internal analysis.
And you're okay with that?
No, I'm going to tell you, 25%, I've been told by many CEOs that immediately it reverses the flow of money outside back into this country. Because, again, this is the strongest economy in the world. We have the best educated workforce. We have all kinds of benefits here in the United States to doing business that, you know what? 12% or whatever it is in Ireland, if you can be in that 20 to 25% range as a corporate rate, according to all of the experts and the people running these companies, now you suddenly become very competitive around the globe because of all the additional variables that go into this analysis.
A quick question to get in here before we go to news on the border adjustment tax. That's something that President Trump wanted. It would tax imports and would not tax exports. Do I have that right?
No.
And okay,
no,
how does it work?
You have the policy right, but this isn't something that President Trump wanted.
Oh, he didn't.
No, no. This is actually, this was Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady on the House side. This was something when Paul Ryan was the chair of Ways and Means before he became the Speaker of the House. He actually was advocating for this, and then Kevin Brady carried it as part of the House plan. On July 28th, before the Congress went into the August work period and we didn't have session, there was a joint statement by the White House, the House, and the Senate that the border adjustment tax was off the table.
Understood, and I was going to say that, but I wondered what you think of the policy of it overall.
The policy overall, I don't have to at this point.
Yeah, well, you have a view on the specifics of...
I was very concerned. I will tell you that one of the questions I asked our speaker at a private meeting was, what happens when the dollar spikes? If you do this, there's a real possibility that the dollar will spike, and now it makes us very non-competitive, uncompetitive with the rest of the world. It could create a real problem. And his response was, well, there's a mathematical formula. And my response was, getting back to weather, predicting the weather, it's a lot like economics. I think you need to know more about it. I know that our agricultural community, a lot of the folks in this state were in favor of it. On our retail side, none of them were in favor of it. So I think there was a lot more, and there will be, I think, in the future, a lot more academic discussion about it, a lot more analysis. Before you'd ever do something like that, you better understand what the consequences are going to be.
I hope you don't have a lot of meteorologists in your district for next election time.
Hey, they're doing the best they can.
Congressman Tom Emmer is in the studio with us today, and we're talking about tax reform and some of the other elements of the debate going on in Washington. This is a long-term debate. He's giving us a sense of what's in play and what isn't. I've got some specific questions about what may be on the table there as Congress debates it, but also questions for you here. I'm interested in the debate around the mortgage interest deduction. Tax policy experts who are not politicians will say there's really no reason to hang on to the mortgage interest deduction. It costs the American economy a lot of money. I'll ask the congressman about that. I'd love to hear your views on that and some of the other issues around tax reform. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR. We'll go to the latest news and we'll come back and continue our conversation. To Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. People are being rescued this morning from flooded homes south of Jacksonville, Florida, as Tropical Storm Irma pounds the state with rain and wind. John Ward, the emergency operations manager of Clay County, says crews pulled 46 people from flooded homes by early today, and an undetermined number are still stranded as the area's creeks and ponds are getting record flooding. Cuban state media says 10 people died across the island as it was being battered by Hurricane Irma. Most of them died in Havana, where chest-deep water, seawater pushed several blocks into densely populated neighborhoods. A second bell tolled at 9:03 this morning at Ground Zero in New York to mark the moment a second terrorist-piloted plane slammed into the World Trade Center's South Tower. Today is the 16th anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks. President Trump led a national moment of silence earlier this morning. Trump then went to the Pentagon for an observance. The U.S. has called for a vote on new U.N. sanctions against North Korea, though exactly what measures will be in the resolution remain a mystery. Security Council diplomats say the U.S. and China are still negotiating the text they were late yesterday. Last Tuesday, the U.S. circulated a draft proposing the toughest ever sanctions on North Korea, including a ban on all oil and natural gas exports to the country. And the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the ambush of a police convoy in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Egypt says the ambush killed 18 police officers and wounded 7. Egyptian police and military officials say the attack began when roadside bombs that destroyed and set ablaze 4 armored vehicles. Gunmen then opened fire with machine guns. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
On our Monday, All Things Considered, the latest updates on Hurricane Irma and the Trump administration's response. I'm Tom Cran, news from the scene with context and analysis for how it's being managed. Join me weekdays starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up on NPR News, we'll discuss the decision last week by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to roll back guidelines on campus sexual assault. Then we're going to have several chats in coming weeks about healthcare and health insurance in this state and country. And we're going to get a sense of the best ideas out there. Author T.R. Reid joins me to discuss what he found when studying other countries' healthcare systems. All of that at 11.
Did you catch our debut of Flyover yesterday? Sundays in our area at 3 o'clock. It's our national conversation about American identity and where it intersects with the most pressing challenges of the day. You can find it at flyoverradio.org and listen in next Sunday at 3.
Programming is supported by Sala Architects. You can experience three of Sala's thoughtfully crafted homes on the Homes by Architects Tour, September 16th and 17th. More at salaarc.com/HBAT.
Back to our conversation now with 6th District Congressman Tom Emmer. You were saying actually during the break when I was asking you if this is fulfilling work, and you said it's tough to come into an institution that has all of the rules and the ways of doing things and try to effect change.
It's got more than two centuries of history behind it, and you step into a body that's got 535 members, and then all the others that actually support all the membership. It's a wonderful challenge. People ask me all the time, "Are you having fun?" And I tell them, you know, I kind of wince when they say, "Are you having fun?" Fun really shouldn't be the word. The word is it a challenge? Is it, yeah, it's a huge challenge, and especially right now. There's a complete vacuum of leadership, I think, not only in this country, but around the world. And I think people out there, the people that are listening to your show, Kerry, whether it's Republican, Democrat, or other, they are hungry for people to lead and just be open with them and tell them where they're at and what they're thinking and why they're thinking it, and then to listen to them, to hear them and respond. So
I'm a little surprised to hear you say that there's a vacuum of leadership. You've got a Republican president who you supported during his candidacy and Republican leadership in the House and Senate. Where's the vacuum?
Well, I mean, last week is a great example. I think we have a president that had to get something done by Saturday. FEMA was going to run out of money. We passed a package, one that I supported, out of the House on Tuesday, some $7 to $8 billion in relief for the Harvey damage, the people in Houston, in Texas. And it went over to the Senate, and it wasn't happening. It wasn't happening the way the president needed it to happen. So what did he do? He sat down with the other side, and he did a deal.
That would be the Chuck and Nancy, who are his
absolutely.
New best friends.
So,
and you're good with that?
Well, no, I didn't like the deal, but I don't hold it against him. I think that if we, and in this case, if the Senate would have done what they needed to do to give the solution that was required in this circumstance, the president wouldn't have felt compelled based on the short amount of time that he had to get a deal done. So, and I'm not talking about just the Republicans. My goodness, the Democrats are in a complete civil war. Everybody is trying to figure out
is going to lead. Congressman, I think I could understand your statement of a vacuum of leadership if Democrats ran Congress and President Obama was still in the White House. Republicans are running the show in Washington, and you're here to say that there's a vacuum of leadership.
Actually,
it's kind of puzzling.
I think last week the Democrats actually ran the Congress, so we'll see.
Well, maybe they're stepping into the vacuum. Is that necessary?
I'm talking about you. In order to govern, in order to lead, Kerry, you can't do it sitting in the back row. You're going to have to stand up, and you're going to have to say, look, this is what we're trying to all get to this conclusion. This is our goal. Whether a Republican, Democrat, Americans need this. How we get there is where we're supposed to differ. And if you're going to lead, if you're going to govern, you're going to have to stand up and say this is the way we're going to go.
So is this a message for Speaker Ryan, or is this a message for Senate Majority Leader McConnell?
Well,
who are you really talking
to? It's
for all
of us. It's for myself and everybody.
But when it comes to Washington leadership, which is what we were talking about, I mean, who is this really aimed at?
Well, I just told you. It's our people have to put out a very clear message, which we've done on many things. And you and I are talking about one that I think we've been very clear on, which is tax reform. Now you got to get it done, and you're going to have to get it over the finish line. That comes from healthcare is a great example, right? It went over to the Senate. What happened? You've got to be able to get these things finished. You've got to be able to push them along. Otherwise, you're not doing your job.
Do you think you're personally making a difference by being in Washington for people?
Slowly, I think we are. I think
you individually. I don't mean the Republican majority.
I don't usually say I or me. So when I say we, I'm talking about my entire team. I can't do this on my own. I've got a great staff. I've got great people that work with me. And I think we are making a difference because one of the things that we're trying to do in our short time that we've been there, you know, ultimately you want to be able to impact policy. You want to be able to impact process. I think right now what we're trying to impact is culture. I think far too many people in Washington think politics is supposed to be a zero-sum game. In other words, in order for some person to be successful, somebody else has to lose. That's wrong. Somewhere along the way, we got off the road where it's about, look, Kerry, you and I might have, and I'm not suggesting we do, but we might have different political persuasions when it comes to how we want to get to a place. But we both want the same things. We both want good education available for our kids. We want clean air and clean water. We want an economy that's actually open for everyone so they can succeed and realize their highest dreams. But we might have different ways of getting there. And if I'm working with you, the idea shouldn't be that if for me to succeed, you have to lose. And we're trying to change that in the culture. That's the part that I just I wrestle with every day when we're there. And I think we are making a difference.
Well, I was going to ask you, since you seem committed to the idea of that, what's one thing you can point to say, I'm focused on the culture of Washington, and here's something I can show you in which I've made a change?
Well, on policy stuff, it's Cuba. I would give you that as the first example. But the stuff you don't see is what I'm talking about. And it's mostly the way we work with the young people who are on the Hill. You know that Washington is it's a place that is run by young people, even though we are all the elected members. You've got these 20 to 30-something people who go to Washington. They start as interns. They become staff people. They are growing up in this culture. And it's really important that when they take that step and they try to say, look, we beat them, that you turn around and say, that's not the way this operates.
So so the change that you're affecting is in the schooling of some of the young people who are working on Capitol Hill in Washington.
Guidance. I mean, if you are an adult and you have life experience, you need to understand this is not a zero-sum game. And you have to start passing that on to the people that work with you and around you. And you have to call it out when it happens. There's a great example that one of our leaders during the healthcare vote on the House side, when we passed what was the beginning of the discussion out of the House over to the Senate, mm-hmm. one of our leadership's Twitter accounts tweeted out something to the effect, a victory for conservatism. That, I guarantee you, was done by a young person who's responsible for a social media account. And I've got news for that young person. Healthcare is not a Republican or Democrat issue. It's not about conservatives and liberals. It's about making sure that Americans have access.
Somebody better tell Speaker Ryan that, because he talks about conservative values in healthcare all the time.
Values is one thing, but it's not about talking. Kerry, it's not about saying to Nancy Pelosi, you lose, I win. It's about making sure the American people win. You can talk about conservative values.
Congressman, isn't that exactly why the Republican majority opposed President Obama's health care plan for years and years? I mean,
I wasn't there, but I would tell you the reason I would oppose it is because we shouldn't have a government takeover of health care. I want to make my own decisions. I do believe Minnesota was leading the way. I think Minnesota is a place that is very unique. We are always ahead of the curve. And in this case, we had a program that wasn't perfect, EMCHA, for pre-existing conditions. We were doing things that other states were not doing. And by turning it over to a one-size-fits-all, top-down solution from the federal government, we take away our ability as Minnesotans to innovate, to create, to do the things most important to our citizens. And I objected to that.
Come back and talk about health care, okay? I'd like to do that.
I'd love to.
I don't want to get off track too far here. I do want to ask
Can I mark this down as a town hall?
Sure. You want to do a town hall? Let's do it.
Hey, David's here somewhere. We can talk to him about it before I go.
Sounds good. I do want to ask you about the mortgage interest deduction, because while Americans would like, I think, to see tax reform, at least that's what the polls show, they hang on pretty tight to stuff like the mortgage interest deduction. It costs the American economy or costs taxpayers a lot of money. Should it stay in tax reform or go?
Well, the interesting thing is that's one of the things that's off the table. I have been told that the home mortgage interest tax deduction is not going to be part of the discussion. And there was another one, too. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it was the charitable tax deduction is off the table as well. I was told two are off the table.
For good – I mean, are those for political reasons?
I believe they are.
But how do you feel about that?
Well, no, I'm not going to even go into it.
Do you think the mortgage interest deduction should be in the tax reform debate? Let me ask it that way.
I said it wrong when I said I'm not going to go into it. I will go into it from a tax policy standpoint. If you were going to be a tax policy purist, you would take out all deductions. You would take out all subsidies. You'd probably have – in my belief, I'm kind of a I agree with not the consumer tax as much as I would think just a flat tax is probably a better way to approach this. But that's not what we're doing. And what they have said is they've put this deal together because there are serious political concerns. You know how it is. This is why you're asking me the question.
But I'm asking you from a policy standpoint, is it good economic tax policy to get rid of the mortgage interest deduction since you're about to do tax reform for the first time in 30 something years?
What do you think? Well, it's not on the table,
But what is your own personal opinion as a representative to Congress?
Yeah, I'm not the PhD when it comes to this. I would rely on experts, which are on both sides of this issue.
So
they believe that from the ability to allow people to own their own homes in this country, it's an important deduction.
Is there a political reason you don't want to say where you stand on that?
Well, yeah, because I haven't taken a position on it.
Is there a reason you haven't taken a position on it?
Yeah, probably because I don't have to. It's not going to be on the table.
Because you know that it's sensitive politically. Is that why?
Well, everything's sensitive politically, Carrie. I can only tell you what they're going to do. The border adjustment tax that you and I talked about earlier, I didn't take a position on that one because you have to evaluate right up until you're going to vote for that thing, and then you have to take responsibility for that vote. Up until then, unless you have some expertise, some background that can say with 100% certainty, this is right and that is wrong, or this will succeed and that will not, I think you owe it to the people that you work for that you keep an open mind right up until the last possible minute.
Call for you from Frank in Detroit, Michigan. Frank, I know it's been a while. I really appreciate you waiting. What's your question for the congressman? Hi, go ahead.
Well, more of a comment, I guess, than a question. But, the congressman has been talking about the historically demonstrated benefits of tax cuts. But I think, Congressman, that you ignore that after Reagan's tax cuts, the deficit rose. And he was not an ideologue. And so rather than tolerate an increase in the deficit, he signed into law tax increases as well as tax decreases. In fact, he signed into law tax increases four times. Eventually, he made a deal with Tip O'Neill. And I will tell you, as a liberal, that I would gladly go back to those tax rates because they were fair. They were the same for everyone, regardless of their source of income. So if someone made his money by investments, and if someone made his money through labor, they were taxed at the same rate. And if you look at the 1986 tax reform report, you will find very clearly that it states people should not pay different taxes based on their based on the sources of their income.
So Frank, is there the specific question is, it sounds like you would go back to the tax rates of the Reagan administration when they cut the deal to raise taxes. Have I got that right?
I would go back to that, to the 1986 Tax Reform Act, because it was fair.
Okay, Congressman, what about that?
Well, I think in great part that's pretty much what they're trying to do, but not to the letter of what the 86 Act was. It's the same concept. But I have to, Frank, I appreciate that you listen all the way from Detroit, Michigan, and I would throw this out to you. You said eventually Reagan made a deal with Tip O'Neill. I would disagree with you strenuously. I think history has not been fair. On my side of the aisle, we wax poetic about the years of Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan could not have been Ronald Reagan without Tip O'Neill. And it was not eventually. it was right from the outset that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan actually created their partnership. And I would suggest if you look at Reagan's history, he was more of an ideologue. But once he got to Washington, D.C., he tried to do the things that he knew he could accomplish without being so strident and without giving up the principles that he believed in. And he respected Tip O'Neill. He respected the fact that Tip O'Neill, this is the discussion I was having with Kerry earlier, they both had a place they wanted to get to. They both have a certain set of values that they do not want to compromise, but that doesn't mean that they can't reach an agreement within that set of values that achieves what both of them knows they need to accomplish. And that's what we are so desperate for in Washington right now.
Congressman, I was recently in Arizona, and there were newscasts saying that a couple of Arizona companies have been asked to submit the second stage of the border wall. I'm interested in whether you think, indeed, as the president continues to say, that Mexico is going to eventually pay for that wall, and that that is not going to come back on American taxpayers. What do you think?
Again, I'm going to leave that to the president to continue to explain to us how he's going to do this. But from the House side, where we set the budget, we've already voted on some of the funding for this, not nearly what the president, and people have to understand, the border wall is not an invention of this president. This is something he talked about during his campaign, but Congress actually passed this border wall under the Obama administration years ago.
The question is, the president talks about the infrastructure of that wall is different than what exists now in most places along the border and what President Obama talked about.
My point, though, Kerry, is not that. My point is, under the Obama administration, Congress actually passed the legislation that requires a border wall. They never funded it. The design of the wall, that's a completely different thing.
But no, the design idea of the wall is what's so expensive, which is why I'm asking you about
it's
whether...
It's always going to be.
Which is why I'm asking about whether you believe that ultimately, if what the president wants comes to fruition at the border, American taxpayers are going to be on the hook for that, or as the president continues to say, Mexico will ultimately pay for it.
I expect him to keep his word.
You expect Mexico to ultimately pay for it?
I expect the president to keep his word.
You expect Mexico. His word is that he will require that Mexico pay for that wall.
Again,
so you're saying I think that's true.
The president makes certain commitments. I expect the president to honor his commitments until he says he's not going to. So I expect him to honor his commitment.
Congressman, I thank you very much for being here. Thanks very much. Will you come back and talk health care?
Love to.
Good.
Thanks, Kerry.
6th District Congressman Tom Emmer, I know we didn't get to a lot of your questions and I didn't get to a lot of your tweets here, and hopefully he will be a man of his word and come back and talk health care.